So, going back to just review where we've been, and I'm going to put the link for the source sheet into the chat so that everybody is able to download it if they don't already have it. There. Last week we started our series by talking about who it was who came to the New World in the 17th century. Who were the Jews who arrived? And we noted you don't have a lot of Jews showing up in the 17th century. It's not large numbers. But there are two major factors, which we went through last time, that influenced Jews to go. One is the turmoil and especially the bloodshed that they're experiencing in Europe, not going through all of those different factors right now. And then second was the issue of economic opportunity, the fact that they would do well. Sorry, hold on one second. I'm just going to do something to try to make sure my mic and speaker are working properly. I think they are, but it should be good just in case. Okay, so once again, the second element was the economic opportunity from involvement with international trade, something that the Jews had particularly good connections for because of their connections to other countries besides their own, and their connection to Jews in other countries and their experience in international trade. Okay, fine. I did want to also go back to one note, which I didn't mention last time, and I feel like a bad Canadian permanent resident for not doing so. I didn't address the question of Jews in the northern part of the New World. So just to address that briefly, at this stage, 17th century, there are none. That was easy. You don't have any known Jews living in what would become Canada in the 17th century. The earliest known Jew in what would become Canada was a woman by the name of Esther Brando, who was in New France for a year in the 1730s. At that point, by law, New France was Catholic. So, you know, that created certain problems, obviously. It's possible that there were Jews who were living, you know, as conversos. It could be that there were Jews who were living undercover, who had come over from Europe to avoid persecution there. That I can't speak to. But known as Jews, Esther Brando seems to be the first one. In 1749, you get a small community that settles in Halifax. And doesn't survive. And then there's a fellow named Samuel Jacobs who shows up near Montreal in 1759, and then someone named Aaron Hart who's with British troops in Montreal in 1760. And then further along in the 18th century, you finally get a synagogue called She'erith Israel that starts. That's in the 1770s in Montreal. She'erith Israel was named for She'erith Israel in New York, what's now known as the Spanish Portuguese Shul in general. Diane writes a message in the chat wanting to know where do these Jews hail from. So my understanding is that they would have been coming from France if they ended up in those communities, but I admit that I'm not sure. I'm not 100% sure about that. Okay, that's just to make sure that we address the Jews in what would later become Canada. Now we have to move forward. We've looked at what drove Jews to the New World, that we now understand. But one thing that I think we ought to think about and keep in mind as we go forward is what sort of Jewish community are these circumstances going to create? What are you going to see in Jewish communities that are formed in this kind of an environment? Meaning, you're starting out in a new world without strong Jewish institutions. How much hold is Jewish tradition actually going to have? So that's a key question to think about. What will be the position of rabbis in these new communities? What kind of authority are they going to have in these new communities? And when we get to the discussion of slavery, we have to ask ourselves the following question. If our focus in arriving in this world is going to be safety and financial security, what's going to be our cultural attitude towards those who are not of our community? How much are we going to look out for those who are not members of the Jewish community? That's something to consider as well. I'm just watching the chat at the same time because, you know, normally I don't like to use the chat, but I think with a group of this size, it's sort of a must. Anne notes that Esther Brandeau, who came to New France, came disguised as a young man. That's a fascinating story in its own right. You can look it up online. There's quite a bit about it that I've seen. Okay. So, religious life among Jews who came to the colonies. We started to talk about this at the end last time. We discussed a little bit the attitude of European rabbis toward travel to the colonies in the 16th and 17th centuries. And I noted that it's really hard to tell what their attitude is. It's not like you can find a lot of primary literature on it, which is surprising, because we have a ton of literature from European rabbis of that time. If they were speaking on the topic, one would have expected that it would be readily available. It's just not around. We do find that they were aware of exploration. That we absolutely do find. If you take a look on the sheet, and again, for those who weren't able to get it in the emails, I have put the link in the chat where you can download it. But I brought you a reference, first of all, which I think I mentioned last time, from Don Isaac of Barbanel, writing at the end of the 15th century, where he speaks about the discoveries made by explorers. And he talks about the idea of the lost tribes of Israel reuniting, or the various, not necessarily lost tribes of Israel being reunited through the discoveries of the explorers. I actually went back after last week's class to the original text of Abarbanel's comments on this. And the more I read it, the more I wonder whether he's talking about travels to the New World in the Western Hemisphere, or whether he's talking about explorers who went east to India, meaning not those who are looking for the Indies, but actually those who went to India. The reason I wonder is because Abarbanel, as I noted last week, is writing in the end of the 15th century, like in the 1490s, maybe first years of the 16th century, and I'm not sure to what extent he would have had reports from the Americas at this stage. So I'm not as confident as I was last week that he's actually speaking about the Americas. However, we definitely find others, as you move forward in the 16th century and into the 17th, who are talking about the New World, who are talking about the Western Hemisphere. There was a rabbi, Avraham Farazol, who lived in Italy the end of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th century. He wrote on quite a few different areas. He wrote a commentary to Chumash, the Bible. He wrote a commentary to the book of Job. He wrote a commentary to Ecclesiastes, to Kohelet. He wrote philosophical works defending Judaism against Christianity and Islam. He published, interestingly, prayer books for women, specifically geared towards women. So if you look on your sheet at source number 3, you find a quote from a work of his called Igrot Orchot Olam. I know that I have some Hebrew speakers on this. So if any of my Hebrew speakers would like to speak up and say, what exactly is Igrot Orchot Olam? Igrot Orchot Olam, what would that mean?
Letters of the ways of the world.
Say that again, Chaim?
Letters of or for the ways of the world.
Right. Letters of the ways of the world, or the pathways of the world, the paths of the world. He's describing travel. Right, that's what he's. That's it's a travelogue, more or less. So in chapter 29, you find this description. Take a look at source number 3. Description of the ships coming to the New World. Those who sat on the masts. This, by the way, is my translation. In general, when you see English on these sheets, it's my translation of something, unless it was originally published in English, or unless I note otherwise. So his is originally published in Hebrew. Those who sat on the masts saw a great and long land, green, entirely settled. And I'm not sure what he means when he says entirely settled. That's why I added the question mark. But that's what he writes in the Hebrew. It's Miyushav. Crowned with mountains and valleys and hills and great forests and rivers of sweet water. And when they traveled around this coast for more than 1,000 parasangs, 1,000 parasangs, when he says that here, what he means is a really, really long space. A parasang is about 4 kilometers. So 1,000 of them would be 4,000 kilometers. But I don't think he means it literally. He's just saying a really large number. They traveled around this coast for more than 1,000 parasangs. They thought perhaps it was a very large island. Then they concluded, based on what they saw of the extent of the shores of that land and the way it turned and traveled, that this was actual land. It wasn't an island. This is a continent. Longer in dimension than the land and broader in the sea is the phrase that he uses. He's quoting a biblical verse, Aruchame Eretz Mida, Urchava Mini Yam. And then they called it a new world due to its size and length. We discovered America. It was actually a continent. He also, by the way, talks about India and travels to India. I noticed Margot Gewirtz wrote in the chat that the Silk Road ran from Damascus to India and China, and it saw Jewish merchants from the 10th century already. So she agrees that Abarbanel was likely writing about Silk Road travel as opposed to travel west. I think that is correct. But certainly, Rabbi Faretzel here is talking about exploration in the new world. I also mentioned last time Menashe ben Israel, who was from Holland, who was the one who was credited with convincing Oliver Cromwell to readmit the Jews in England after they had been expelled. So in his work, Mikveh Israel, in source number 4, he quotes a traveler by the name of Aaron Halevi regarding the 10 lost tribes being found in the new world. And he says, and the elders fulfilled their wish. The elders of the tribes the Jews found in the New World fulfilled the wish of the travelers, testifying and telling that the God of the children of Israel is the true God, and all of the commandments inscribed on the stone tablets are true. And at the, quote, end, they will reign over all the nations on earth. The children of Israel will travel from their places and reign over this land. In other words, he reports that people who were found by the explorers in the New World testified to the veracity of the Torah. Must have been a very exciting time. To get accounts like this. Knowing what was actually there in the New World, obviously you can't assign any credibility to this account. But my point, really, in bringing these sources, aside from the fact that they're interesting, is that there's a lot of excitement surrounding exploration. We don't find people saying, don't go there. And I think that largely it's because the people who are going there are exploring, they're visiting, but it's a business trip. They're not planning on living there at this stage. You're going, you see what's there, you get resources, you trade, and then you come home. That's a very different experience from people who are going to go there and set up colonies. But to take the next step, you do find Jews arriving in the New World, as we've talked about in the 17th century, and you find rabbis who went, and chazanim, cantors, who went as well. And in last week's sheet, I gave you a list. Here in source number 5, I just gave you the website where you can find that list. I didn't feel that we needed to reproduce the entire list on the sheet again. Common elements in the stories of the rabbis who went were, first of all, that they often only went temporarily, quite possibly intending to be there temporarily. We're there, and then we're going to come back to Europe. We find that some of the rabbis were quite learned and had published works of Jewish law. But it's not necessarily true for all of them. And you can tell that because some very strange community practices developed in this new world, which may indicate that the rabbis themselves were not always so knowledgeable. And you'll see what I mean when we get to the slave discussion and some of the interactions between the Jewish community and the slaves that are in the colonies betray some kind of a very odd understanding of the way Jewish law is supposed to work. So we're going to talk about that. That'll probably be the beginning of next week, maybe the end of this week. But as an example of a learned rabbi who went, and this is everybody's favorite example when you read the historians on this, Rabbi or Chacham Yitzchak Avohav de Fonseca. That's the name of somebody who is credited as being the first rabbi in the Western world. Rabbi Yitzchak, or Chacham Yitzchak, Avohav de Fonseca. Avohav de Fonseca is because he followed the practice that was popular back then of merging paternal names and maternal names. So his father's family was Avohav, his mother's name was Fonseca, and so he blends the two. It's a little bit tricky to figure out what he did versus what other people named Yitzchak Avohav did. The meaning. There were several rabbis named Yitzchak Avohav in Spain and in Portugal through this period and earlier. There was a very accomplished Rabbi Yitzchak Avohav in Spain in the late 13th century. There was another one in Castile in the late 15th century. And there was another one in Portugal at the same time as the Yitzchak Avohav we are talking about. For all we know, he was a relative. I don't know. So it's kind of tricky. You have to sort out the stories. And it isn't always straightforward as to who is whom. But here's what I do think we know. Chacham, or rabbi, I keep going back and forth because rabbi is really a term that Ashkenazim put on him. He would have been known more likely as Chacham, the term that the Sephardim used. So Chacham Yitzchak Avohav was born to New Christians, as they were called, also known as conversos, hidden Jews, in Portugal in the year 1605. The family moved to Amsterdam, where you could practice Judaism more safely, and returned to Judaism. He actually was a friend of Menashe ben Israel, who I mentioned earlier. He was accomplished as a paitan, a religious poet. He was accomplished as a Kabbalist. He was a leading sage in the Jewish community in Amsterdam. He was the head of a community called Beit Yisrael, the House of Israel. And yet, in 1642... he picks up and he moves to the Dutch colony of Recife, which we mentioned briefly last week. I'm not quite clear. I'll just mention this here. Some sources that I've seen say that Recife was part of a larger municipality called Pernambuco. However, I've seen other sources that they seem to think that Recife was Pernambuco, which I don't think is correct. I think it's that it's part of the larger Pernambuco. But he comes there in 1642. Why 1642? Anybody know? What would have been special about 1642, such that he would have gone then? Everyone's being so quiet. In 1642, the Dutch took the... No, not Inquisition. In 1642, the Dutch took control of that area from the Portuguese. When it was under the Portuguese, no Jew was going to be able to live openly there. 1642, it becomes Dutch. And at that point, Jews are able to go, and Rabbi Avohav, or Chacham Avohav, becomes the first rabbi in Brazil. The community took the name Tzur Yisrael. What does Tzur Yisrael mean? Ethi, you're muted. Sorry?
Rock of Israel.
Rock of Israel, correct. Rock of Israel is a term that is associated with God as a protective God. So they name the community the Protector of Israel. Interesting for people in Toronto. The school there that they created was named Eitz Chaim. So apparently that's been a popular name over time. No word on whether there was any trademark discussion at all when the one started in Toronto. So, what's not clear is why he went. What exactly was it that led him to go? So there's a Rabbi Oren Zweider who wrote an article some years back on Chacham Abohab. And he dealt with this question of why Chacham Abohab went. He thought maybe Abohab was on the younger end of the Amsterdam rabbinate, so maybe he just like drew the short straw, like Jews are going there to start a colony, you need a rabbi to go, so you're the most junior, and therefore you get assigned to go. He also suggests, and this is borne out in Chacham Abohab's writing, that it could be he went as an idealist. The community needs a rabbi, I'm going to go and keep them safe. And that may be. Others suggest, per an article in the Jewish Encyclopedia, that he went for financial opportunity, just like many of the people who went. This had good possibilities for remuneration. He wrote religious poetry, I mentioned when he was in Europe. He wrote further religious poetry when he was there in Recife, and particularly surrounding an attack by the Portuguese on the colony. If you take a look at the source sheet, it's source number 6. I brought you a long excerpt from Rabbi Zweider's article because I felt it really illustrated it better than anything that I would that I would add on my own. So I'm actually going to read this through and explain it. You can see it in source number 6. By 1646, he writes, the Dutch colony was under siege by the Portuguese. The Jews of Recife were terrified at the prospect of Portuguese conquest, knowing that Portuguese victory would also migrate the Inquisition to the New World in Brazil. Right? The truth is it was already there, but it would bring it into this area that had been under the control of the Dutch. To respond to the threat, Rabbi Abohab composed a vidui. Vidui is a prayer admitting sin, confessing what he believed to be the community's sins, as well as beseeching God to spare them. Okay? He's composing a prayer for the Jews to say, to appeal to God for help. God, we have sinned, we've done things that were wrong, please forgive us, and please help us. That's what he composes. In addition, Abohab composed a poem recounting the suffering of the siege, as well as the Jews' rescue. These two documents are critical to not only understanding the specific events of the Portuguese threat, but also Abohab's general perception of the Recife community and his rabbinical life in America, as he goes on to explain. Abohab's poem is an account of the Portuguese siege. It is also a deeply personal reflection on what it meant for him to be sent as a rabbi to the far end of the world. He used biblical words with similar pronunciation and spelling to allude to Brazil. And what he means by that is seen in the next line. The word in Hebrew for iron is Kor HaBarzel. Barzel is iron. Kor HaBarzel is an iron kiln. And that's a phrase that the Torah uses, a term the Torah uses to refer to Egypt. When the Jews are in Egypt, they're suffering there. He used in his essay, he used the term melting pot. He doesn't mean melting pot like society getting everybody to blend together. He really means a kiln where you're gonna fire up metal. Similarly, Abohab referenced the new geography in which the Jews found themselves. Arise, build cities in the forests, he writes, is presumably a reference to the forests surrounding Recife. Drink in Aram, the cold rivers, a reference to the rivers and waterways upon which Recife was built. More importantly, however, for Abohab, Brazil represented a state of exile. In a number of places in his poem, Abohab alluded negatively to the remoteness of Brazil. At the very beginning of the poem, he depicted the Jewish residents of Brazil, himself included, as dwellers in the shadows of the universe. And he goes on in that vein. I'm going to the next slide. For Abohab, the Americas were in the shadows, and the only reason that could explain his presence there was that it was a punishment of exile for sins he had committed. It's rabbinic exile. That's the way that Chacham Abohab describes himself. And then he goes on in this piece here to describe the shortcomings of the community and their materialism, specifically as described by Rahab Moab in his vidui, in his prayer confessing sin. And if I'm jumping to the last paragraph of source number 6, the writings of Rabbi Yitzchak Avohav, the first rabbi in the Americas, reveal challenges that would continuously confront rabbis, immigrant and native alike, in the Americas. His writing reflects the uniqueness of the Jewish experience in the New World from its earliest stages. His story demonstrates that the challenges that have faced spiritual leadership in the Americas are not new. They began with the very first rabbi to settle, however, shortly in the New World. In other words, this feeling that we are sinful, this feeling we are too material, we're looking out for material welfare instead of religious welfare, is not something that rabbis started talking about now. It's something that rabbis have always felt was a concern, and they always spoke about. That's something that emerges from his religious writing. Interestingly, Chacham Avohav is also believed to have asked the first shaila, the first question of Jewish law, in the Western Hemisphere. It's certainly the first one we have on record. And it's a very interesting question that he asks. It's not really about the Western Hemisphere. It's actually about the Southern Hemisphere. And here's the problem. In Jewish liturgy, there are prayers for not only healing, salvation, and so on, but also prayers for financial welfare, including a blessing recited as part of the Amidah 3 times a day, in which we ask God to take care of our crops. And during the rainy season, we pray, V'tein tal umatar livracha, give rain and dew for a blessing. Right? That's the phrase that we use in the Amidah. When it's not the rainy season, we say v'tein bracha. We just ask God to give blessing on the crops. We don't ask God for rain. So, in Israel, you start praying for rain. You start including that prayer for rain a couple of weeks after the holiday of Sukkot. You gave the people who had gone on pilgrimage to Jerusalem for Sukkot enough time to get out of the land on their way home. And then, after that, you start praying for rain. And the prayer for rain continues until Pesach, until Passover. Outside of Israel, historically, Jews have worked instead with the seasonal calendar of what is today Iraq, what was Babylon. Because at the time when the blessing was instituted, Jewish life outside of Israel was based in Babel, was based in Babylon. And therefore, you would pray for rain based on Babylon. You follow? So far, so good? Okay. Well, that leads to the following problem. When you go to the Southern Hemisphere, your rainy season is entirely out of sync with Babylon. It's also out of sync with Israel, right? It doesn't make any sense at all for you to pray based on the schedule of Babylon. You're going to be praying for rain, specifically at a time when you don't want rain. It's not good for what you have growing out in your fields. And notes in the chat, the economy of Brazil was founded on sugar and slaves. So I'm going to get back to the slaves, later on. But it's just, it's fairly basic in terms of their needs. Like, even no matter what your economy is based on, you need food. You're not getting food shipped to you from Europe. You need to be able to grow things. And you need rain at the time when you want rain. Not in, not based on the schedule of rain in Iraq. So the question that is asked by Chacham Avohav is, when do we pray for rain? He doesn't answer the question himself. He sends it away to Rabbi Chaim Shabtai, who was a major rabbi in Amsterdam at the time, also known as the Mahar Chash. In source number 7, I brought you the opening paragraph from Rabbi Shabtai's response in which he describes the letter he has received. We don't have Chacham Avohav's actual letter. We just have the response from Rabbi Shabtai. He says, they have sent from there, from a distant land in the Empire of Brazil, a place far south of the equator, where the South Pole is elevated 20 degrees and more, and the North Pole is hidden below the horizon 20 degrees and more, and I don't actually understand what he means when he says elevated, or I understand what he means when he says it's below the horizon. I'm not sure what he means by elevated, but his point is, we're squarely in the southern hemisphere, and the days of the year and order of times is altered from summer to winter, such that their sunny season is from Tishrei to Nisan, roughly speaking, September to April. And their rainy season is from Nisan to Tishrei, roughly speaking, April to August. And they need rain from Nisan to Tishrei, not from Tishrei to Nisan. They're on the opposite schedule. So what are they supposed to do? And after some discussion of this question of Jewish law that has been sent to him from the colonies, his answer is actually, never pray for rain. He doesn't want them to go against the schedule of the rest of the Jewish world. He doesn't want them to go against the traditional schedule. On the other hand, it doesn't make sense to ask God for rain when rain could actually be destructive to the crops you're trying to harvest. So his answer in the end is to say, just say, V'tein bracha, God give blessing. And if there's a time when you need rain, there's another place in the Amidah where you're allowed to insert personal requests in the blessing called Shema Kolenu, God hear our voice. And in that blessing, say, God please send rain. That's his answer for this very first question that is sent from the New World. Well, this New World experience, unfortunately, did not last for Chacham Abohab and did not last for the Jews in Recife. As we already noted last week, Recife was doomed to be retaken by the Portuguese. And in fact, if you take a look at source number 8 from the Jewish Virtual Library's article on Chacham Abohab, it's actually not their article, they took it from the American Jewish Historical Society, we get the description of the retaking of Recife, and in particular, a point here, take a look at source number 8, a point in the Portuguese conquest. You know, when I was growing up and hearing stories of Jewish history, I shouldn't say inevitably, but very often Jews were kind of placed as the center of the story, right? You know the story of the kid who's in school and the teacher is frustrated because every essay the kid writes about some historical thing, it's always about this and the Jews and the Jews' role in it. So finally the teacher says to the student, I want you to write an essay about elephants, and sure enough, it comes back with elephants and the Jews. So that's very often what it was like when I was in school. Jews are at the center of whatever the story is. And you start to wonder, is that just our perspective, and that's the way that we look at it? And the answer is sometimes yes. But here, a lot of it does seem to have been about the Jews when the Portuguese retook Recife. Take a look at source number 8. Again, from the American Jewish Historical Society. For the first 4 years under Abohab's leadership, Recife's congregation, Kahal Kodesh Tzur Yisrael, probably should be Kadosh, but they wrote Kodesh, thrived in an atmosphere of religious toleration characteristic of the 17th century Dutch. The Portuguese, however, had retained control of the Bahia region of Brazil and never ceased longing to recapture Pernambuco. In 1645, a Portuguese Jesuit, I don't know how to pronounce his first name. Is it Hoam Yoam? I don't know. Anybody want to unmute and tell me? No? Okay, then we're going to go with Yoam. Fernandez Vieira convinced the King of Portugal to regain Recife because, quote, that city is chiefly inhabited by Jews, most of whom were originally fugitives from Portugal. Vieira continued, they have their open synagogues there to the scandal of Christianity. For the honor of the faith, therefore, the Portuguese ought to risk their lives and their property in putting down such an abomination. Yes, there is apparently, according to the Jesuits, a primary motivation of let's get this land back because there are Jews there. But it gets better. In 1646, Vieira and his army attacked Recife, hoping to divide and conquer. Vieira offered the city's Jews protection on condition that they not participate in the battle. The Jewish community unanimously rejected this offer, took up arms with their Dutch comrades. The Portuguese besieged Recife off and on for a total of 9 years, unable to defeat the inhabitants, unwilling to retreat. During this prolonged ordeal, Recife's Jews gave their food, property, and lives in defense of their freedom. Throughout the siege, Abu Hab encouraged all the resistors, Jewish and Dutch alike, and led prayers asking God to protect the colonists from their enemies. Recife held out through 9 years of deprivation. In a poem he later wrote, Abu Hab described his congregation's ordeal. Many of the Jewish immigrants were killed by the enemy. Many died of starvation. Those who were accustomed to delicacies were glad to be able to satisfy their hunger with dry bread. Soon they could not obtain even this. They're in want of everything, were preserved alive as if by a miracle. It is the oldest known Hebrew text written in America that has survived to the present day. And then look at this. In 1654, the Dutch garrison could no longer hold out. And the governor agreed to surrender. To their credit, the Dutch insisted that the Portuguese not slaughter the Jewish inhabitants as a condition of surrender. The Portuguese honored this proviso, but demanded that the Jews leave Brazil. So the Dutch, first of all, the Portuguese are attacking specifically because of the Jews. The Portuguese try to get the Jews, I don't imagine that was the only motivation, but it was a motivation. Number two, they try to get the Jews to stay out of the battle, but the Jews insist on playing a role. And number three, the Dutch arranged the safety of those Jews who had been in the colony at the time when they surrendered to the Portuguese. So Chacham Abu Hab at that point returns to Amsterdam. We know that some ended up going north and ended up in New York, as we discussed last week, and we're going to have to come back to them at some point soon. But he goes back and he becomes rabbi of the Jewish community in Amsterdam until his death in 1693. There were other De Fonsecas who were in Curacao and then eventually in New York later. I don't know if they were related on Chacham Abu Hab's mother's side. That I'm not sure about. But that's one story of a rabbi in the New World. And it's fascinating to think of his experience there. There was also a rabbinic dynasty known as the Pardo family from Spain. Here again, it's very confusing to figure out who was whom within the family. Here the confusion is because there are certain personal names that show up over and over again. There are a number of rabbis named David Pardo, also Joseph Pardo, and Josiah Pardo. Those names keep on coming up. Nonetheless, I want to go through the dynasty a little bit just to give you some sense of who they were. It's a very interesting story here. Rabbi David Pardo lived in the 17th century and was rabbi in Suriname. In source number 9, I gave you the list of the Pardos I'm going to talk about. He was the son or grandson of a rabbi, Joseph Pardo, who was the rabbi of Venice and then later of Amsterdam. And he was a writer of religious books when he was still in Europe. He wrote the works of Jewish law, one published in 1679. Then you have Chacham Josiah Pardo, or Yoshiyahu in Hebrew, of Curacao. His father was a rabbi David Pardo, but a different one. He was born in the year 1626. And was rabbi first of the Sparta community in Rotterdam, and then in Amsterdam he was a rabbi, and in 1674 he became the rabbi of Curacao. 1683 he goes to Jamaica. And then there's some dispute as to when he died. In one reference I saw, he died in an earthquake in Jamaica in 1692. In another article I saw, he died actually in 1684. But he wrote various works of Jewish thought. He wrote homiletics. But the most famous of the rabbis Pardo was probably actually someone who was not a rabbi at all, but rather a chazan. And that was Saul Pardo. But Saul Pardo changed his name. He anglicized it. This is the first record we have of a Jew anglicizing their name in the Western world, right? Something that would become a time-honored tradition for Jews when they came over. He turned the family name to Brown, which is, of course, translation of Pardot. It wasn't like some creative name. But he lived in Newport for a bit, and then he came to Sheirith Israel, the Spanish-Portuguese shul in New York in 1695, where he served as their chazan, before ultimately returning to Curacao and passing away in 1702. So you don't just have these solo rabbis who showed up, like Chacham Abohab, and eventually went back. You also have rabbinic dynasties in this new world. Someone sent me a message in the chat asking how we know that the rabbis weren't learned. So I want to make sure to clarify what I said earlier. I didn't say that none of the rabbis were learned. However, it seems clear that some of them were not. And it affects some of the practices that we see develop in the communities in the new world, which I want to get to. Okay. So far, so good. I'm going to pause here. Do people have questions before we proceed? Questions? I prefer questions, I think, over long comments.
How about it?
Yes. Claudette.
Yes. Rabbi, if one may say in Brazil, and you said that the rabbi spoke in not trade rain period, is it possible that one could pray for rain in Israel, not in the region there are? Has any rabbi decreed that?
So this is a very, very interesting question, which I'll briefly address. I mentioned that the practice of Jewish communities outside of Israel has historically been to pray based on the Babylonian schedule. However, from time to time, this has been challenged. The most famous challenge, at least that I'm aware of, was by Rabbeinu Asher. Rabbeinu Asher, also known as the Rosh, was a fascinating, fascinating figure. He first was a rabbi in Germany in the 13th century, I think the beginning of the 14th. Late 13th, beginning of the 14th, and because of persecution, he fled to Spain, where he became a great authority there, so that he represented both the Ashkenazi world in Germany and the Sephardic world in Spain. And he became one of the principal architects of Jewish law. He had a son who went on to become also a great architect of Jewish law. He's a very important figure. And he had a campaign to change the schedule for praying for rain, saying it makes no sense, in Germany or in Spain, frankly, it makes no sense for us to be praying based on Iraq's schedule. You can make the argument we should be praying for Israel, as you're suggesting, and pray on the Israeli schedule. You can make the argument to pray based on where we are now. And he was adamant that they should change, but he lost. He couldn't convince everybody else to change. And it's something, a move that was very striking. He wrote a public letter on Chol HaMoed during Pesach. Chol HaMoed, the intermediate days of the holidays, do not have the same religious status as the first days and the last days of the holiday. They're not that sacrosanct. However, they are they're holy in their own right, and normally one wouldn't publish a letter on those days, but he published a letter recanting his position. Not because he had changed his mind, but because he couldn't convince anyone. He said, I have to follow the majority, and he ceded the position. A lot has happened over time in terms of this, but to date, it's still what we stick with. Chaim Besson writes in the show, wrote to me privately, sorry Chaim, he gave me a note about the J in Portuguese. He was doing it privately in order to preserve my dignity, but that's okay. This isn't the first time that I didn't know something. The J in Portuguese is pronounced as it is in English, except that it's always soft, like the S in measure. So J-O-A-M would be Joam. Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay.
Rabbi.
Yes.
I just want you to see, I have some books.
Yes.
And from Curacao, the date of these precious stones are the tombstones that they found in Curacao from 1674.
Wow. Fascinating. Who published that?
Hello?
Sorry?
Yeah?
Precious Stones of the Jews of Curacao was... All right, I can look it up online. Thank you. I'm going to talk a little bit more about Curacao shortly, but let's see if you'll have something to add, I think, possibly from those books. I wanted to shift gears to talk about the communities and specifically rabbinically led observances in the New World. In other words, Jewish practices that one would expect probably involved rabbis. So first of all, we said last time that most of those who came to the New World were Sephardim. They came from communities that had been uprooted from Spain and Portugal, ended up in Holland, England, and France. You had conversos coming directly from Spain and Portugal. There were some Ashkenazim, I should note. It wasn't as though they were all Sephardim. I brought you a reference in source number 10 from Dr. Malcolm Stern in an article, Ashkenazim and Sephardim in the Colonial Era, in which he notes that there were in New Amsterdam, that community that was formed with the Jews who came from Recife, there were at least two Ashkenazim. There was Asher Levy, who was on that boat from Recife. And then there was a fellow named Yaakov Bar Shimshon, who actually had arrived 2 weeks earlier from Amsterdam. And he contends that Asher Levy and Yaakov Bar Shimshon formed, so to speak, their own Ashkenazi community. Such that, you know that the Jews in New Amsterdam, when it was Dutch, faced all sorts of trouble from Peter Stuyvesant, the governor of the community. So Stuyvesant would not allow the Jews to stand guard. He said instead that they had to pay a tax to pay for the fact that they wouldn't stand guard. So Asher Levy challenges that and says, I want to stand guard. And Dr. Stern makes the point that there's only one other person he joins within it, and it was the other Ashkenazi, Yaakov Bar Shimshon. So he argues there was an element of Ashkenazi solidarity there within the community. It's an interesting idea. I brought it for you in number 10. You can see it there. The level of observance among Ashkenazim and Sephardim there is subject to some debate, and here I'm responding to an email somebody sent after the class last week. It isn't clear in general not only what the status was of religious status of life in the colonies was, but the religiosity of Jewish communities in mainland Europe is also unclear. Meaning, this is before conservative and reform. Those are not, a blip on the radar yet. The Jews of this time are either more observant or less observant. There are those who are believers in the Jewish tradition in full. You had deists, people who believed that God started the world, set it going, and is impersonal and not directly involved. Spinoza will come along, of course, in Amsterdam, towards the latter part of the 17th century. And that will be a significant influence. My point is simply to say that you have what I called last week, a definite lack of clarity regarding the Jewish life both in Europe and where they go in hang on one second, I'm just going to mute someone. Where Jews are in Europe and where Jews are in the colonies. And last week I quoted for you from Jonathan Schorsch, what I brought you here in source number 11, about the fact that Jews brought kosher food and they gave their settlements and their plantations Hebrew names and biblical names. That does certainly indicate some level of religious knowledge. One thing that I found very interesting, an observation by Dr. Stern. Take a look at source number 12. He's talking about the community in New York in the 18th century. He says, the congregation, recognizing that the Ashkenazim were more versed in halakha, in Jewish law, engage them for such synagogue functions as shochet and bodek. A shochet, the one who slaughters the animal, bodek is the one who checks to make sure that everything is done right, as well as the mo'el. So the mo'el and the shochet were Ashkenazi, because the Ashkenazim were more versed. However, for the conduct of worship, the New York congregation sought Sephardim who could chant in the Sephardic mode. They wanted Sephardi Chazanim. They were greatly assisted by the appearance in 1761 of an English translation of the Sephardic prayer book for the eve of the holidays, followed 5 years later by a more complete prayer book for the year, both presumably the work of Isaac Pinto, an educated layman. So you had English translations way back when. The New York congregation remains Sephardic in liturgy, even though the Ashkenazim tend to be more knowledgeable. So let me just ask you, why would the Ashkenazim have been more knowledgeable than the Sephardim? What would you think? Anything?
The smaller communities, the Sephardim were more influenced by we talked about the Muslims in the areas they were in. And the Jews were in shtetls more in Europe, so they learned than they were in Sephardim.
So I think that's a hard claim to make. I hear you, Susan, but I think I'm not so sure. And the reason I'm not so sure is on both the Sephardi and Ashkenazi side. The Sephardim had not been living in Muslim lands since the middle of the 15th century. Meaning the Reconquista, when the Christians take over Spain. These Sephardim who we're talking about had been living under the Christians in Spain and Portugal, and then were evicted, right, or lived as conversos. The Ashkenazim, for their part, who we're talking about are Western Europe. We're not talking about Eastern Europe shtetl life, really, as a place where they would have come from. Diane suggests that maybe there were more yeshivot set up in Ashkenazi lands. I'm not so sure of that. I would go with what Barbara Barak just put in the chat, which is, it's the impact of the turmoil on the Sephardic community. The Sephardic community, you're talking about people who either lived underground as conversos or had to pick up and move to places where they didn't have institutions. And I think the turmoil of expulsion and the lack of historic communities was a major influence. Think about what happened when Jews came to America and Canada at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. You're starting all over again in terms of building a community, even if you're not running from an Inquisition. So it becomes very hard for people to stick with things. I will note, though, that Dr. Stern makes the point that the community kept the Sephardic liturgy and says it was because the Sephardim were wealthier. The Sephardim had more money than the Ashkenazim, therefore they were the ones who were funding the synagogue, so even if they couldn't hold the ritual positions, they made sure the synagogue was going to remain Sephardic. Some things never change. So that's an interesting note in its own right. But in terms of rabbi-led practices, you find communal prayer going on in the 1660s already. In Suriname in 1665, before that you had private worship starting in 1652. Other colonies in places like Martinique, Nevis had Torah scrolls, synagogues, schools, even when the population was small. Curacao, which we were just shown a book about before, was the largest of these communities. I highly, highly recommend the article by Dr. Stern, which I referenced in number 12, and I gave you a link for the article on Google Books, where you can find it. And I'm going to give the source sheet again in the chat so that people are able to download that. And then you can click on the link instead of retyping what you see in source number 12. But Dr. Stern's article talks about each community and what they had. And it's really a fascinating read. There are some things that he says that I think are unfortunately mistaken. Just on historical basis. Not everything that he says there is correct, but there's still better information there than you can find in a lot of other places. One thing that he says, which I know I have people here who have been to Curacao and know things about Curacao, and people who have been to Portugal and to Amsterdam, so I'm going to ask you this question, and then I'm going to come back to a question that was in the chat. Dr. Stern notes something which I have heard about from many people before, which is that there was a sand floor on the synagogue. It was a sand floor in the synagogue in Curacao meant to muffle footsteps. The idea is, if the Inquisition ever comes back, fact, they won't know that we've been worshiping there. And I see a head nodding there in the Verona screen.
Two reasons. One is to remind the desert sand that the Jews went 40 years to the land of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is to muffle the sounds in the basement where they were praying.
Ah.
During the Inquisition and after the Inquisition, the Morenum, for them not to be found as praying for studying the Torah.
So here's...
I was in the synagogue in Curacao, and it's exactly that, to muffle the sound of prayer.
Got it.
Correct.
There's one in Prague that also has a sand.
Good. So Sylvia's point, and here I'm gonna take over. Sylvia's point is exactly what troubles me here. I taught a class on this on this issue of the life in Curacao about 10 years ago, and someone pointed out to me that there's a synagogue in Amsterdam called the Esnoga, which has a sand floor. Meaning it isn't just something that was done in the New World and by people who were living under the threat of the Inquisition. So now my problem is, if this was really done in order to protect from the Inquisition, and it was really done in order to hide, then how do we make sense of the fact that it existed in Europe in places that didn't even have an Inquisition? That's my problem. It has the ring a little bit of a tourist story that you would tell. Yes, sorry?
I can take that a little bit further back because of the history. The Sephardic Jews who were praying at that time didn't want people outside hearing them.
Mm-hmm.
So they put sand on the floor so that they wouldn't know that the Jews were praying in that area.
Right. So you're supporting the idea that it was actually a protection.
Yeah.
I hear you. There are a few different options. Barbara writes in the chat, maybe it's a reminder of the Inquisition and a tribute to those who died. It's an interesting possibility. Moish has his hand up. I always get priority if someone's got their using the official Zoom hand up, hand up symbol. So, Moish, go ahead. You're on mute, though. Sorry, Moish. You got to unmute yourself.
Okay. But it wasn't on this subject. Although I did see this sort of shul.
Got it.
I wrote before.
Okay. So one note just on a question that was asked in the chat a little while ago. Was there a corresponding code like the Shulchan Aruch in the Sephardic world? So the Shulchan Aruch actually was a Sephardic work originally. The Sephardic work, the Code of Jewish Law, was written originally by Rabbi Yosef Karo, a rabbi from Turkey who moved to Israel, lived in Sfat. That's the origin of the Shulchan Aruch. And then Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in Krakow, added Ashkenazi notes to it, so it came to represent both the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim. But the origin of it is actually Sephardic, and indeed we're going to come back to it when we talk about Turkey, except that I'm looking at the clock and we are actually at 11 a.m. I actually lost track of time. So I've been having a good time. I hope you have as well. But boy, do we have more to talk about. We have to talk about marriage issues and Jewish marriage in the New World. We've got to talk about Turkey and why Jews ate turkey there when it was a New World bird. And we have to talk about slavery and kosher food and eventually Coca-Cola. So I don't know how we're going to get it all in. Maybe I'll add weeks for those who are able to stick around further into July. I don't know. We'll see. But I'm looking forward to continuing, God willing, next week. I'll include a little bit of a summary in the follow-up email that I send today. Hopefully you'll all receive it. Those who use Simpatico, please complain to Simpatico about the fact that some emails have been blocked. Maybe there's a way to whitelist the address. I don't know. All right. Thank you very, very much, and I look forward to seeing you next week. Be well.